Hey, my name is Nathanael Frankenthal. I'm here in Israel. I don't know, I was born here, but I came back about 11 years ago. My phone number, for those of you who want to take it down, is 02-653-6447. Usually you can call between 10:30 and 11 at night. That's usually when you could catch me. You're welcome to try any other time. That's the time when it's your best bet. My email address is shilot7, that's S-H-I-L-O-T, the number 7, at gmail.com. And you're welcome to communicate while you're here, after you leave. I like to stay in touch. We just opened up a group for all the guys at the Machon. So far I'm the moderator, might change, but anyone wants to join it, this way we could all stay in touch, even after you guys leave. And you're welcome to posting. So far I'm the only one that posted. It'll be whatever you guys make. Your picture's up there already, Micha.
No, I want to post like the
you could upload files. I gave you an open account. I don't know. You send me an email and then I send you an invite, or you could just go to the Machon Meir group and write a request to join, and then simpler if you send me an email and I automatically add you to the list. We also have, we try to record all of our shiurim, but that's for your benefit. To access any shiurim at www.torahforme.com. That's where the shiurim are. And without further ado, we'll begin. What? The Machon Meir site eventually is supposed to put up a link to there. But that's where the shiurim are. The audio shiurim, the video shiurim on torahforme.com. Yeah. I also have, for those who are interested, an outline in Hebrew of the classes. Anyone who's interested can let me know after class and I'll give you my notes. Basically what we learn here is in the notes. Our class schedule, for those of you who didn't see it on the schedule, on Sunday, 7:30, now it's 6:45 to 7:35, 7:40 until Maariv. It starts 45 minutes before Maariv. We learn Intro to Talmud and Tan de'Beil Yo, which is a Medrash. Intro to Talmud, we learn Igeret Rav Shiragon, and basically we try to go off on tangents with stories in the Gemara to learn about the Tanaim, the Amoraim. It's an intro to Talmud. We do cover that topic, but within that topic, we're trying to cover also not getting a base knowledge of the stories of the Shas, going according to the order of the people in the Shas. Sunday evening we have two classes. One is Nach and one is Minyan HaBayit. I'm considering changing the Nach class for this semester to a class in Pirkei Avos. I don't know yet. We'll see. We might do that instead. But for now we do Tanakh and Minyan HaBayit, the Jew and his home, which we will touch on tonight as well. Wednesday we have a sign-up sheet. Again, 45 minutes before Maariv, people can sign up and we could talk one-on-one, 15-minute slots. And then we have our Parsha summary class, which basically goes, and then we go summarizing the different Rishonim on the Parsha as best as we can. Yes. The Thursday night, every second week, we have a late night class. We start after our Arvit, and we go till we have strength, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., depending on your strength. We will have class tomorrow night. Usually we try to have pizza and other refreshments during the class, and if the guys are up to it, then we wanted to end the class with going to the Kotel for prayer, and it worked out. Like, it worked out once, and then the next week the guys didn't have strength. We could we go by taxi. The Machon orders a taxi. We alter, and every semester guys say yeah, we want it. We do it the first Thursday, and then by the next Thursday no one has strength. Friday morning we have class with refreshments. We have a Friday morning 45-minute slot. You guys could sign up. Again, 45-minute slot. You guys could sign up for 15 minutes, and we talk one-on-one, whoever wants, and whatever you want. You guys sometimes set it up, and we learn together. That's in your control. You could do whatever you want during those 15 minutes. We don't shoot spitballs one another, but anything serious we could do. And then we have class, which is serious we could do. We do, right now we're halfway through the Rambam's introduction to the 10th chapter in Sanhedrin. We're going through the 13 principles. And then after that, we have a class in Halacha, so as to cover ground. Our classes are focused on covering ground. Shabbos morning, for those of you who want to be early birds, if you want to wake up either for Vasikin or for a 6:15 minyan, you got to check with me. But those weeks that I'm here, we try to have a class at my home at 8:15 for those of you who woke up and prayed early. So again, we have a class with refreshments and Kiddush at my house, which the newcomers could find out from me or the guys where I live. This Shabbat, Bezrat Hashem, I'm home. Bezrat Hashem, we'll have class at 8:15. The deal is, though, that just like you guys don't have to wake up early, if no one's looking over you if you wake up, I have to be afforded that option too. I can't know what my night is going to be like with the kids. So you wake up, and so far I've only missed once. The usually tied onto the door. If you come, you see a bag tied onto the door, don't knock and wake the kids. If there isn't a bag tied onto the door, it means I'm up. And the classes, our steady participants are some guys in the Machon and my two children, who are ages 3 and 1. So you have to take into account part of the class time is going to be, I mean, we learn together. It's not really a class. We're learning together. And then we do Ma'aral, and we do the Siddur a little bit, and if you guys have your own topics that you want to do, we could do them. We learn, and we do Medrash. So that's Shabbos morning from 8:15 till 10:15. So now you have a summary of our classes, and without further ado, we'll begin. We're holding in the middle of Sefer Vayikra. Sefer Vayikra is the middle of the Torah, and we're going to begin with an introduction. This is the beginning of the semester. When God revealed himself to the Jewish people at Sinai, and Moshe went up Mount Sinai, God gave him the Torah, the written law, together with the oral law. And in general, our approach is that the written law was given all at Sinai, together with the oral law, our understanding of the written law. More details as to exactly when the Torah, which parts of the Torah were given, will be discussed maybe tomorrow night. On Thursday nights, we have all kinds of things in our Thursday night class. And if not, then maybe Shavuos, we'll see. I want in the near future to have a class on that. But for now, we're going to take it at face value that everything was given at Sinai, all of the written law and all of the oral law. And the written law begins with creation. It begins with creation. After God revealed himself and said, "Hi, I'm God, Ten Commandments. I took you out of Egypt, all the miracles." So then God also reintroduced himself and said, "I'm the creator of the world," and told us the whole book of Bereishis, Genesis, how the world was created, the Jewish exit from Egypt with the 10 plagues, 10 commandments, and the Jews' sin with the golden calf, and are commanded to build the tabernacle, the Mishkan. And then we begin Sefer Vayikra, and Sefer Vayikra focuses on what's really done within that tabernacle, in the Mishkan or in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. And the first few parashas focus on the sacrifices. And then we enter a new concept of Tumah and Tahara. And Tumah and Tahara are really spiritual concepts that the Torah teaches us, that there is some kind of spiritual impurity called Tumah. And it's something that we with our naked eye can't see. People who are more spiritual can see it. And it has effects on the world. Just like we know there's holiness. And you ask me, "Show me holiness." And I'll say, "Well, don't you see it just there? Look at Rav Bigun's face. Don't you see holiness?" And you'll say, "No, I see a beard, see glasses. I don't necessarily see holiness." And some people see it, some people don't. And some people think they see it, and really they don't. And that's most of the people who see it. So the same holds true for the opposite extreme called Tumah, some kind of spiritual impurity which the Torah reveals to us exists. And in last week's Parsha, which we have not yet had a Parsha class on, but Be'ezrat Hashem we will fill in the missing Parshiot that we missed during the break. In last week's Parsha, the Torah discussed different animals and vermin and species that can impart spiritual impurity upon their death. Their carcasses, their bodies when life are impure. And after discussing all the different wildlife, the kosher animals and non-kosher animals, and the tumah associated with them and the vermin, the Torah at the end, seemingly as an afterthought, speaks about man's impurity. And that's our parsha. Our parsha focuses on different types of impurity that can afflict mankind. And in order to understand this, we're going to begin with a Gemara. The Gemara addresses the question, why was man created? Everything was created first. The earth, the heavens, everything. And at the very end of creation, along comes man. So the Mishnah is a Mishnah in Sanhedrin which discusses How do we threaten witnesses? The truth is, I have to stop. I'm sorry. We're going to rewind a little bit. The way we do our parsha class is we always do an overview of the parsha, and then we go in depth. So this introduction will be for our in-depth part. Right now, we'll quickly run through the parsha, and in 2-3 minutes, we'll get back and start going in depth. The parsha tells us that if a woman has a child and it is male, then she is tamei. She is spiritually impure for 7 days. On the 8th day, she immerses after 7 days, and then she has 33 days of purity, after which she can bring her sacrifice. And if she has a female child, if she has a female baby, a girl, so then she is impure for twice that amount of time, for 14 days, and then she has twice the amount of time purity, 66 days, at the end of which she can bring her sacrifice. Now, obviously these 33 and 66 days that we call days of purity, they're days of partial purity. We refer to the pure aspect of them, but they're also partial impurity, because only at the end of these days may she bring her sacrifice, and only then is she fully pure. The Torah describes the sacrifice that she brings. If she's wealthy, she brings an animal. If not, she brings 2 birds. And she gets atonement. And we're going to have to discuss, what does she need atonement for? She did the most beautiful thing in the world. She brought a child to the world. What atonement does she need? And then the parasha goes off to teach us about tzaras, which is some kind of white spot that God sends to a human, or human hair, or to a person's clothing, or to a person's walls. And that spot is tameh, in part spiritual impurity. When a person has that spot, he could be tameh. When a house has that spot, anything in that house is tameh. There's a whole masech about this, but we're doing an overview right now. And the Torah says, let's say he has a spot, he comes to the kohen, and the kohen looks at it, and he sees that the hair has turned white within the spot. So then he knows it's an impure, it's a blemish of tzaraz, and he says he's tameh, and the man is kicked out of the camp. He has to live alone until he gets better. Let's say the hair hasn't turned white, so we seal him off for 7 days, and after 7 days we take another look, and if after 7 days it hasn't expanded, so we give him another 7 days, and then if after the second series of 7 days it remains constant, we say he's impure. If it starts dulling out, so we say he's pure, and again, he has to immerse himself, and he is pure. When a person has tzaras, so there are many different laws. There are different types of colors which can be tameh. Generally, in the flesh, we say it has to be white. There are 4 different types of white, which we will discuss. The Torah discusses what happens if there's white spots, and inside the white spots, there's regular flesh. We're not going to go very much in depth when it comes to the spots, because we don't really know a lot of the details. The Torah discusses what happens if he has a boil, and on top of the boil there's a spot. All kinds of different things. How we analyze what comes from spiritual impurity and what comes really from physical skin disease. The person has a burn, and then it develops. So then the Torah teaches us about these spots that can afflict a person's hair on the head or a person's beard. And over there it's a yellow spot. Again, different ways of checking how big it is and how when it makes him impure. A person who's bald or clean shaven also can have spots on his face and head, all kinds of different spots that make a person impure. A person's garments can also have spots which will make them impure. These spots are a different color. A person's home can have spots. And again, when it comes to a person's clothing, so we burn out the spot. When it comes to a person's house, so we take out that part of the wall which has a spot, and then ultimately we might end up knocking down the wall. Different details which we might get to tonight. And that's a basic overview of the parsha. Now, let's get back to our introduction. After having learned about all the different animals and their impurities, the Torah brings us the impurities of mankind. And mankind is last on the list. So in order to understand this, we're going to roll the time clock back to the time of creation, where man was also last online. He was the last to be created. The Mishnah in Sanhedrin discusses, how do we threaten witnesses? Witnesses are coming to testify before us, and they're going to claim that so-and-so is deserving of the death penalty. They warned him and they told him not to desecrate the Sabbath. They said, if you desecrate the Sabbath, you'll get the death penalty. Don't do it. And he said, I don't care, I'm doing it. So we say, wait a second. Before we believe you, we're going to check you out. Do you know we're going to check you out? We threaten them. We tell them, you know, maybe you're just quoting something you heard. Maybe someone else told it to you. Even someone you believe, someone you trust. Are you sure you really saw everything you're telling us happen? Maybe you don't realize, but we're going to grill each of you in separate rooms and we're going to compare what your testimony is. Are you sure that you're going to be able to stand up to it? We're going to ask you questions like, where was the sun at that time? What tree was near him? What clothing was he wearing? What clothing was the defendant wearing? We're going to really grill you. We want you to know that if you were to be a little bit lying on a monetary issue, you could pay it back. But if you're going to say something that's a little bit off on this issue, you can never bring a man back. Don't you know that Cain killed Abel, Cain killed Hevel? And when God came to Cain, God told him, you know, the blood of your brother's bloods, in plural, are yelling from the earth. Why does it say your brother's bloods? Because when we look at a human being, we don't just look at him. We look at the potential. The whole world began with one man. And that means that every person can create a whole world. Meaning all of us come from one man. So when Cain killed Hevel, he killed the potential of the world population being double. If you're going to testify that this person should be dead, we're going to treat it as though you're trying to destroy a world. You're not only killing one person. You're killing many, many people. You're killing all the children he would have had, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, to the end of time. And that's why God says the bloods of the man, of your brother, are yelling from the earth. Do you know that man was created single? God didn't create many men. When God created every animal, God created many animals, many trees. But man was created singular. One man was created. Do you know why? We tell the witnesses to teach you that the world came from one person. So that we'll value each and every person. So that when we look at an individual, we'll recognize that this individual, you know what? This individual is the whole world. In Judaism, we look at every individual person and we say, that's a world. The world came from one man. And that's to teach us the importance of each and every individual. And if a person destroys an individual, we treat it as though he destroyed a world. If a person sustains one individual, and that's how we treat tzedakah, we say when you help one individual stay alive, we consider it as though you've kept the whole world alive. You've given sustenance to the world. Why do we all come from one man? So the Mishnah continues and gives more reasons why God created us all from one man. So there would be more peace among mankind. Person shouldn't be able to say, you know, two people were created. And one was great, and one was bad. I come from the better one. And the Mishnah says, you know, the Gemara says, today, even though we all come from one man, people are always taking pride. I come from this state. I come from this country. I come from this family. The Mishnah says, the Gemara says, if we would be born from two men, you imagine what the world would be like? They'd say, God created two. You know, one was better than the other. I come from that great one. So God said, at least on this front, I'll try to encourage world peace. A person shouldn't be able to say, you know, maybe the reason there was two men created, because there were two forces in creation. So we know there was a singular God who created a singular man. And this also shows us the greatness of God. That man, when you take a stamp, you get the same result. When you take a form and you make coins out of a form, you take a mold, you get the same thing out of one mold. But God created one man, and from that one man came all of us with the different genes and the different faces, and no two people are exactly alike. And therefore, every person is supposed to look at the world, and this is a very well-known line, and say, "Bishvili nivra olam," the world was created for me. Meaning a person should think to himself, I am like the whole world. I am one of the most valuable people in the world. I'm an MVP. I'm like Adam. The world was created for me. And this recognition is supposed to bring a person to say, well, do I want to destroy this world? God put me in this world with a purpose. My purpose is to serve him. I shouldn't mess up now and bring the whole world down. And this has greater implications if we think about it. People very often allow themselves to do things because they say, well, what's the big deal if I do it? You know, if so-and-so does it, you know, if President Bush cheats on his taxes, then everyone says, what's going on? If I cheat on my taxes, if a rabbi is caught stealing, oh, wow, that's a big chil Hashem. But me, what's the big deal if I cut a line? What's the big deal if I borrow something without permission? So the Torah teaches us not that way. Every person has to recognize that he is the world. He is the beginning of another world. And the way a person is how he's going to teach his children and how his family is going to be. A person can't say, I live in a vacuum, it's only me. There's no such thing as only me. Every one of us is the whole world. Every one of us is the potential for the whole world, and we want, just like we all think, boy, if Adam wouldn't have sinned, imagine how much better this world would be. Well, if I wouldn't sin, imagine how much better the next generation, the future generations would be. We're responsible for the continuum of the world, and each and every person has the continuum of the world, and each and every person has that responsibility. So the Gemara on this Mishnah says that the world was created from one man, and part of the idea is that there should be more unity among mankind. And part of the idea is to tell us God's greatness. And the Gemara says, why don't we all look alike? Because if we'd all look alike, we could cheat. We could say, I am he, and he is me. And then we could each take one another's objects and then go prove in court which one's the right one. So God made us all unique so that we're recognizable. God made us all have a different voice so that our wives could recognize who we are at night when they can't see. Don't forget, once upon a time they didn't have electricity. And God made us all have different thoughts where we can't read one another's thoughts so that a person won't be able to steal from one another. If I'd be able to read your thoughts, I'd know your PIN number, I'd be able to access your bank account, I'd be able to know where you hide all your jewelry. So the Gemara says that's why God made it, that we each cannot read one another's thoughts and we have different thoughts. Well, okay. I think on the simple level it makes a lot of sense. So then the Gemara continues. Man was created on Friday afternoon. And the idea was that after God finishes all of creation, along comes man. Man can't say, I had a part. I had a role in all of creation. God created everything before you were on the scene. God says, I created everything. You can't say, you created. A person shouldn't think, I'm so great. That's the second reason the Gemara gives. Meaning if a person starts being haughty, so in heavens they laugh at him, they say, you know, the mosquito that you swat in the wall, that was created before you. So that it's supposed to give us a message that we're created last, not to be too haughty. The Gemara gives more reasons, but based on these reasons, our parsha also enumerates us last. We're supposed to learn humility from that. I always mention that when we used to get rides in, this is the same message, but doing it in a reverse way. I'm used to get rides in a car with Rabbi Feinstein. So you know there's the middle seat with the hump. So everyone always wants to get in either first, where they could get a side seat, or last. So he'd always be honored with getting in first. So the first thing he'd do is sit in the middle, so he's over the hump. Now no one has to think about where they're going to sit. He's sitting over the hump. So we're here in creation, and here in the description of the Tumah, the Torah is putting us at the end of the list. We don't have to think very much. Everything in creation was created for us on the one hand, and on the other hand, we're not supposed to be too proud. We're supposed to remember, hey, even that little fly, that mosquito came before us. The Torah tells us that when a woman gives birth, she becomes impure. And that impurity is equal to the impurity of Nida. And the Torah also teaches us some of the laws of Nida in our parsha. We know that biblically, when a woman has her period, so she is Tameh. And Tameh means spiritually impure, and this has many applications. We're going to start with the most spiritual. We know that there are holy foods in the temple. The sacrifices are holy. We know the truma that we take off 140th, 150th to give to a coin, that's holy. So one may not touch those things or eat those things when one is Tameh. The act of Tumah that has relevance today. When a woman has her onset, when she has her period, so she becomes Tameh. And from that minute on, she and her husband may not even touch. They're not allowed to sit on the same sofa. Certain circumstances, if there's enough distance between them, so we say, he should sit first, he should get up first. Those are details you'll learn when you're holding by getting married. But the Torah teaches us that there has to be distance. They don't even pass a cup of water from one another. They don't pass a key from one to the other. There is almost zero contact between them. Physically, there is zero contact between them. They're allowed to talk, but they're not allowed to talk in a way that will bring them to lightheadedness. So a Jewish couple has to really contain themselves. And this period of impurity is called Nida. Nida stems from the word either Nidui, ostracism, because like we're separated now. She's separate from her husband. Or else it comes from, it could come from, okay, we'll leave it with that understanding for now. So when a woman gives birth, she automatically gets this impurity. We say that the second she gives birth, even if, let's say, the Gemara says there's a concept of Leida Yevesha. We don't see it today, but the Gemara says there could be a woman giving birth, maybe this is a case where a woman miscarries, and it comes out dry, no blood comes out. So today I don't think we know of such a phenomenon. But the Gemara says that even so, we say the second she gave birth, she's Tameh, if she had a boy for 7 days, if she had a girl for 14 days. And after that, she becomes pure by immersing herself in the mikveh waters. This concept of Nida is something that people have a very hard time with. Especially newcomers to Judaism or to Orthodoxy. And it's interesting that there's been a lot of research done on this, on the psychological impact of leading a holy home. We say this is the source of holiness in a Jewish home, the fact that the couple can contain themselves when they are forbidden. And all the research has come up with the similar conclusions, which were already stated by the Gemara. The Gemara says that Rabbi Meir used to say, why is it that the Torah made a woman impure for 7 days? And nowadays it's 12 days, but you'll learn more about that when you're holding by getting married. The Gemara says, "Mitnei shiragilba," because the husband gets used to his wife. He's with her every night. You know, he gets tired of her. "Vekatzba," and he gets disgusted with her. He gets tired of her. So in modern psychology, they'd say that men are polygamists. That God created us with a nature that we're always looking for another one. But the Gemara says that if a person gets free time to be with his wife whenever he wants, which is what naturally would occur once a person's married, unless the Torah teaches us otherwise, then he gets used to her and he gets disgusted with her. Came along the Torah and told us she should be Tameh for 7 days, so that at the end of those 7 days, he will like her like the time that he took her into the chuppah. Meaning the Torah gave us a gift that once a month, a husband gets his wife back, and they start like they started when they got married, newly married. And it's interesting, those of you who are interested, let me know, I could give you the different psychological reports. They did research on the Jewish communities, and they found that one of the things that strengthened the bond between a couple in the Orthodox communities, and it's one of the things, one of the reasons, one of the causes that they attribute to the low divorce rate, is because we have this period. And it's interesting that the Gemara also worded it in a very exact manner. The Gemara didn't say she would have an issue if they'd be permitted all month long. The Gemara says she'll get on his nerves. He's going to be disgusted with her. It's us that get tired of having the same wife and being with her every night. When the Torah says, oh, hold it. You have a period of time where you can't be with her. Suddenly we miss her. Suddenly the whole relationship takes on rejuvenation when the couple get back together again. They did research on Israeli society. And they found that those men that do miluim, that go to the army for a few weeks out of the year, they have a much lower divorce rate than the rest of the men. Nothing to do with religion. And again, the research pointed to the same thing, that it's very healthy for a couple to have periods of time when they can't be together. It reminds them how valuable their marriage is. And this is something which modern research also backs what the Gemara tells us, that men have this tendency to devalue marriage. Today, women are being taught to do that too. But men, traditionally, a day after the marriage, a husband starts lacking appreciation for his wife. 2 days after the marriage, okay. A month after the marriage, that's it. He thinks he could have done without it. So I'm exaggerating, but only a little bit. our tendency is not to be appreciative. And it's interesting that this also can be seen in the story that the Torah tells us of Adam and Eve. Some say that Adam's main sin was his lack of appreciation for Eve. Shortly after he marries Eve, she causes him to sin, and God comes onto the scene and says, Adam, what's going on? And when God pushes Adam to the corner, he says, she did it! You know, I was doing fine till she came along. She gave me the food. I mean, I wasn't eating it, not for her. And God said, wait a second, that's how you're talking about the gift I gave you? So the Gemara again teaches us that us men need this period in order to be more fond of our wives. The Gemara says that, this is another Gemara, that there was a min. Min is Rashi Tevos, is an acronym for the word Mitalmide Yeshua Nochi. One of the disciples of Jesus, when Christianity began, came over to one of the rabbis and he said, you really believe that all those Jews in their homes are keeping these laws of family purity? Can it be that you have a fire burning inside and it's not scorching things? Can't be that every man has a fire burning within him. You really believe that within Jewish homes they're keeping these laws of family purity? So he told him, he quoted him the verse in the Song of Songs and Shir Hashir. The verse says, Sugar Bashoshanim. He made a gate, he made a boundary, a fence, with Shoshanim, with roses. You want to make a boundary, you make it with flowers? Flowers is no boundary. Anyone could trample on flowers. The Torah is telling us that God is testifying about the Jewish people, that for them it's enough to make a boundary of flowers. You look at the flowers, you recognize where the boundary is. You say, that's how God did it, I don't step beyond that. Yeah, but shoes can step on thorns. What? They didn't have shoes. No, I think they had shoes. We see in the Torah already they had shoes. Yeah. Moses was told, take off your shoes. You could also jump over thorns. You could jump over a rose.
Just like a little prayer.
Yeah. How about, did you hear about the British custom that's starting the law of the family party? There's a certain custom in the royals that are because it preserves the...
I don't think it's going to work. Let's see how it works. There, I really don't believe it'll work, because there's another Gemara which tells us why it works. The Gemara says that when Eve was standing near the tree in the Garden of Eden, so the Nachash came upon her. And according to one understanding, it means he literally had relations with her. And the Gemara says, he placed within her his whatever disgusting things that he has. Zuhama literally is like sweat. It's some kind of filthy dirt, wet, filthy dirt. And the Gemara says, from that moment on, the whole world went down. Every child Eve had, and every child that child had, they all had this effect of the Nachash. And when the Jews stood at Sinai, so God said, I am Hashem, your God. God appeared to the Jewish people. And when God said that, so wow, that was like a shower. They came clean. They walked away from Sinai, different people. They walked away from Sinai without that zuhama, that filth, that spiritual filth. And every ger, when he immerses, we say when he goes into the mikveh waters, he goes in, he's got it. And when he comes out, he doesn't have it. What is that zuhama? What is that filth? So our sages tell us that filth is the yetzer hara. So it's true, Adam had a yetzer hara and Eve had a yetzer hara before the Nachash came along. Every Jew has a Yetzer Hara. We all stood at Sinai. Believe me, we have a Yetzer Hara. But it's less. When the Nachash came to Chava, so he implanted within mankind a much stronger Yetzer Hara. And our sages tell us that God blessed the Jewish people that he minimized it. And that's why we could stand up to these commandments. Meaning we can't even expect someone who doesn't have this to stand up to this. It's not... you can't expect it. So that's what he answered, he said, the Torah testifies that we do live up to this. I can tell you, just as a tip to all you guys who, God willing, will get married soon, these are one of the laws that you don't come into contact with until you get married. And then suddenly you have a new series of laws. Wow! And many couples, shortly after they're married, they become forbidden. That's usually what happens. And suddenly, they just got married. And now they're being told they're forbidden. I thought once I'm married, all this is going to be permitted. Now I have to spend 12 days, 13 days, the average is 13, 14, the minimum halachic requirement for Ashkenazim at least is 12, without touching my wife. You should know that these are halachas that a person has to fulfill, and every Jewish home does fulfill. And they get easier with time. Become second nature. The first month is the hardest. The second month is a drop less. And a little bit, slowly but surely, everyone gets used to it. But everyone before you did it. And everyone does it. And that's what the Gemara says. One source that the Gemara quotes is a different verse in Shir Hashirim that says, "Kefelach harimon rakatech." Your temple is like a slice of a pomegranate. You slice a pomegranate, it's filled with seeds. So our sages say, "Kefelach harimon," like a slice of a pomegranate, rakatech. Rakatech could mean your temple, or it could mean from the word rek, which means empty. And the Torah, the Navi over there, King Solomon, is attesting to the fact that even the rekanim, even the most empty person, even they are filled with mitzvot like a pomegranate. We say in Judaism that there isn't a person that doesn't have many, many, many mitzvot. God implanted within us a nature that we want to be good people, and the more a person knows, the better he could be. But even an empty Jew is going to have many, many mitzvot. And this verse is quoted by the Gemara, and the Gemara says, you see, even empty, even amarats, and even people who don't know much, there are basics. People know Shabbos, people know they keep laws of family purity, there are basics. So every person is responsible to keep these laws. These are biblical. And here the Torah tells us that when a woman gives birth, so biblically for the first 7 days, she has this impurity. Now ordinarily, once a woman sees a drop of blood, we say, okay, she's impure. Obviously there are details we aren't going into, but in general, that's the rule. The Torah over here tells us something which today is not applicable halachically. The Torah tells us that the first 7 days, blood is coming forth after she had a baby boy, she's impure. After that, she goes to mikveh, and the next 33 days, she could be spooning forth blood, but she's pure. That blood, we say, Torah tells us an exception, that blood is pure blood. And today, we don't do that. Today, we say that until she stops seeing blood, she's impure. She can't go to mikveh, even though the Torah says that she has these 33 days where we don't regard the blood as being impure. The rabbis instituted that today we treat all blood as impure, and today that's why until a woman finishes getting rid of all the blood that comes after childbirth, which can very often take a long time, she's impure. You had a question? Just tell me your name. Avan. Yeah.
Why did they institute this?
It's a good question, but in order to understand why they instituted this, we have to understand a lot more of the laws of Nida. No, it's a fair question, but it's a long answer. When a woman has a baby girl, so then the first 14 days, regardless, she is impure. And then she has 66 days, where according to the Torah, even if she saw blood, she would be pure. Now, this, again, usually doesn't have relevance, because usually after a woman gives birth, she has weeks of until she's clean. The only time that this would have relevance is sometimes a woman is in the middle of childbirth, and then they see that the baby is in distress, or for another reason, they do cesarean. And then, very often, when they do cesarean, they clean out the womb, take out all the blood from the womb. And then, sometimes a woman can be clean a short time after childbirth. So then a person should consult his local Orthodox rabbi. Yeah?
Does it have any indication on why the girl is doubled with that?
So the Gemara quotes a discussion about this. We'll quote Rabbi Yishmael's opinion. Rabbi Yishmael said to the sages, he said, it takes 80 days for a female fetus to form, and 40 days for a male fetus to form. So the rabbi said, that's not so. The rabbis disagree with Rabbi Yishmael. And they quoted a story to back their opinion, and he quoted a story to back his opinion. They quoted a story that there was once a Greek, if I'm not mistaken, a Greek empress who wanted to check things out. So she had two female servants who were deserving of the death penalty. So she gave them each a concoction that they knew would cause a woman to abort any fetus she has. And then when she knew they didn't have children, she put them for one night in a room with a man, and then she separated them and kept them under lock and key. And 40 days later, she put them to death and opened up their stomach, cut open their stomach, and found a male fetus that was already formed and a female fetus that was already formed. And that's why the rabbis said that male and female fetuses form after 40 days. And Rabbi Shmuel said, you're bringing me proof. who said maybe that concoction that they make for abortions, it doesn't work on everyone. Maybe that female servant that had a female fetus in her stomach, maybe she was one of those people that the abortion doesn't work, and it was 80 days past. And not only that, Rabbi Shmuel says, I'll quote you a story. What story does he quote? Then he says, there was once a Greek empress who had two female servants who were the servants of the death penalty, and they took them both, and they gave them a concoction, and they made them both have abortions, clean out their womb, and then they put them in a room with a man for the night, and then they locked them up under lock and key, and they opened one up after 40 days, and they found a male fetus inside, and they killed the next one after 80 days, and opened the first stomach, and found a female fetus that had just formed. So the rabbi said, well, how do you know that it just formed? So he said, you could tell. You know, the fetus, it was equal to the male fetus after 40 days. So the rabbi said, that's the proof you're bringing us. Who said? Now, we don't trust anyone. So he said, what do you mean? She was under a guard. So the rabbi said, well, maybe she cheated with the guard. How do you know? So you have no idea. That's no proof. So those are two opinions we have in the Gemara. But according to Rabbi Shmuel's opinion, that's why the Torah gives us the law. The Torah tells us that the amount of time that it takes the female to form is the amount of time that the mother is impure. There are explanations among the Rishonim that say that females and males are created differently. The Gemara is a very interesting Gemara discussing the difference between men and women. We're having trouble with the printer tonight. Yeah. The Gemara says, the students asked Rabbi Dostai, the son of Rabbi Yanai, why is it that men are chasing after women and women aren't chasing after men? When a man wants to get married, you see he's all nervous, he's looking after shidduchim, he checks out the girl, we always ask the guy first. So he said, because when a person lost something, he's always looking after what he lost. So we lost a rib, so we're looking for a lost rib. By the way, you guys should just know that this is an important message for you daters out there. If you see that a relationship is developing and you're interested but the girl isn't, so you have to send her signals that you're chasing after, that you're interested. Part of making a girl interested is giving her the feeling that you're interested. She has to always feel like she's being chased after. And this is true within the marriage also. A woman always has to feel like he's chasing after her. Maybe that's why, okay, yeah. Yeah.
My experience.
It's true. You know, you remind me of the joke. A guy says, you want your horse to behave well, you give him feed. So another guy says, you know, that's not true. If I give him feed, he plows the way he should. If I don't give him feed, when I come, he jumps towards me, he's all excited. So that's true. You can starve a person and they'll be very excited over you. God forbid. No. Yeah.
If I understand that a woman is not intrinsically impure in and of herself, and if I understand that a woman's dam is not intrinsically impure of itself, because a postmenopausal woman is not impure. Because a postmenopausal woman is not impure. A woman that has amenorrhea, she's not menstruating, she's pure. And a woman who cuts herself is pure. So,
okay, David, the other answer. Chazal, let's just finish this answer, and then we'll get to the other answer. Remind me if I forget. So, men and women were created differently. The Gemara, we're skipping part of the Gemara. The Gemara says that men have a tendency to turn towards what they were created from, the earth, and women have a tendency to turn towards what they were created from, man's rib. Why is it that when you try to appease a man, you get on a guy's nerves, you do something to get him upset, he'll calm down? If you ever get on a girl's nerves, you ever say something hurtful to a girl, go try to appease her. So there's a whole, I see some of you have experience. So the Gemara says, this goes back a few thousand years, the Gemara says, well, why is it that man you could appease, and the woman, you got to work very hard until you could appease her? The Gemara says, it all goes back to where they were created from. Man was created from the earth. The earth is easy. You could move it this way, that way. It's more flexible. The woman was created from a rib. It's all knock on wood. Then you got to... The Gemara says, I don't know how literally you take it. The Gemara says, how come women yell? Women have a shrill voice. And men are more soft-spoken. The Gemara says, again, they were created from you. You try to bang on the ground, you bang them around. You get a rattle. Okay, so men and women were created differently. And however we're to understand these Gemaras, now we'll leave them at face value, but the reason I quoted them was more so that we should recognize that the issues that we face today are ancient. The Gemara was facing them too. So the Gemara says men and women were created differently, and there's a whole Gemara which discusses what parts of the body a person gets from his father and what parts he gets from the mother. The blood, the bones, the hair, the skin, the bones, the hair, the skin. The Gemara breaks it down. Different things from the father, different things from the mother. Well, male and females are different, and their bodies absorb different things from the body. And because a female baby absorbs certain things from the mother's body, so it leaves the mother's body. She's similar to the mother, right? She's female. And she takes more out of the mother's body, and takes the mother's body a longer time to recover. And as such, the mother remains impure at a lower level. Impureness is coming close to death. It's we know death is impure. Dead body is impure. The house a dead body is in is impure. Anyone that walks within to that house is impure. So the mother is brought down. She's sent down. We view childbirth as a near-death experience. So when that baby girl is born, she's taken more out of her mother. Now we'll come to David's answer. But guys, this is for David. You could listen in. He's going to understand it. You won't and I won't. But he will. So don't ask me. So the text says, I'm just quoting a text. The text says like this. Mother is impure for twice the mountain time as males. By the way, we could because from a female daughter, the mother has 66 days of relative purity. She's not fully pure, but she is. We do say all the blood that comes out then is pure. She could be with her husband during those 66 days. So she may. Today we say halachically not, but biblically she may. It goes like this. A woman has 7 compartments in her stomach. 3 on the right and 3 on the left. And the ones on the right, the 3 on the right are for male children. And the 3 on the left are for female children. And the one in the middle is for a child that is either an androgynous, having male and female signs, or a child that's born with a piece of skin covering that whole area where we don't know exactly what he is. That's called the tumtum. And we know that there are forces of the right and forces of the left. And the tumma comes from the left. And tahara, purity, comes from the right. So it says that when Eve had whatever she had with the Nachash, so he was able to cause that those on the left would be impure, those 3 compartments on the left. So after a woman is with her husband, if she rolls over to her right, other sources say that she'll have male children, and then the sperm is less affected with what the Nachash did, so she's only impure for 7 days afterwards, or 40 days afterwards, depending on which level of purity. But if she rolls over to her left, and then it all goes to the side where the Nachash had more of an impact, so then we've got 14 days of complete impurity and 80 days of not so complete impurity. Okay? Fine. I wasn't going to quote that, but you asked. So, okay, back to our parsha. So the Torah reiterates a commandment which was given to Abraham that this male child that's born, on the 8th day he has a bris milah. And from here we derive a few things. We derive that a bris milah must be by day. This is important for all you guys who don't know when you had your bris, and you don't know who did it. So verify that you had a kosher bris, verify that it was done by a Jew, verify that it was done by day, and verify that it was done from day 8 and onward. Many people had their bris milah, their circumcision done in a hospital. So that you have to verify that it was done. That depends on what. Depends on what was done wrong. But I'll tell you what. See me about that by day. Anyone who has any questions should see me during the daylight hours. Yeah. What? Good question. Whoever has a question should consult his local Orthodox rabbi. No, usually we say the moel does have to be a shomer mitzvot. At least lechatila. If a person has a question, then they should see their local Orthodox rabbi. A moel should be a shomer Torah mitzvot, and a moel should be Jewish. So that's where it gets sticky. No, that's why it gets sticky. There was a whole community that had a moel that didn't keep Shabbos. So it was a community, not in the United States, but on a different continent where they had serious problems. Everyone got their bris milah by him. He was the only moel in town. So each one has to ask their rabbi. So it has to be from day 8 and onward also. If a person had a bris milah earlier than day 8, which is when the hospitals usually do it, 2 or 3 days after the child's born, that's not a kosher bris. So in order to fix these things, provided that anatomically it was done correctly, all that's done is very simple. It's not a difficult procedure. You see, do you ever get a paper cut?
Yeah.
Right? So it's less than a paper cut. All we do is we try to get one single drop of blood to come out from that area. One drop is all we need by a Jewish moel. Now it's not, I do it, and I can tell you that almost all the people I did it to, I don't remember if all, but almost all the people I did it to didn't know when I did the procedure. Meaning, I finished, and they said, when are you doing it? And I said, it's done. It's over. I mean, it's...
What do you use?
I don't use a piece of paper, but it's a very light procedure. It's, I mean, people are very scared. I've had people faint on me. When I said it was done, they fainted. I'll tell you, but okay. So back to our parasha. So on 8 days and 8 days and onward, he gets a bris milah. And then she has 33 days during which he is not completely pure. And this not completely pure has levels. Meaning, we said that a person can be pure with regard to touching truma and kachim, eating truma and kachim, being with her wife, with her husband. So after 7 days, she attains the level of purity that she could be with her husband, biblically. Again, we're not talking about today, but biblically, she can be with her husband, but she may not touch truma or eat truma, touch kachim or eat kachim. At the end of the 40 days, she brings a carbon for a male child, for a boy, and at the end of the 80 days for a girl, she brings the carbon. Now what carbon does she bring? She brings a chatas. And the question is, why does she bring a carbon chatas? So our sages tell us that when a woman is sitting there at childbirth, she's once a woman starts childbirth, so she becomes impure, she starts bleeding at some point. That's part of childbirth. And then her husband may no longer touch her. She becomes forbidden to him till after the she's going to come clean. So that's just for your general knowledge. You should just know that once a woman starts giving birth, the husband, all the laws of nida apply. Now, when exactly you learn, when you're learning your chasm classes, when is the exact minute when the two become forbidden? But from that exact minute on, which might be when she starts seeing blood, could be other things, the husband may not touch her, and the husband may not see any of the areas which he doesn't normally uncover in the home. Meaning she has to say that that's how a woman is during that period until she becomes pure. Which means that in the kosher hospitals, the husband stands behind the curtain during part of childbirth. He roots his wife, but he does it from behind the curtain. Or else, he stands at an angle where he cannot see her uncovered. He may not. So the woman becomes impure, and she goes through an excruciating experience called childbirth. And our sages told us that at some point during that experience, she's going to say all kinds of nasty things about her husband, to her husband, and even if she's man enough or woman enough not to say them, she's thinking them. And the Gemara says that the Torah knew that deep down inside, she took a vow when the pain was hitting her, and she said, never again. Never again am I going to be with that man in bed. Never. And after a minute after the baby's born, she starts thinking differently. And 7 days later, when she's finally holding that baby and kissing him, and she's had 7 days to recuperate for a boy and 14 for a girl, she regrets what she said. She wants another one. She wants another child. Now, she deep down inside really took on a vow. And the Torah over here recognized that she took it out of pain and she didn't really mean it, and she regrets it. So without explicitly saying what her thoughts were, the Torah says, let her bring a sacrifice and this will atone for those thoughts that she had deep down inside. And here we can see a very important lesson that the Torah didn't tell us what the woman was thinking. Our sages revealed it to us. The Torah just said, let her have a sacrifice. And this shows us God's trait of compassion. That God wants her to have atonement, and God doesn't take her to task. How often is it that a husband or a wife has had a very bad day, and they come home and they say something, and the other spouse will never let them live it down? No, even on your worst day, how could you ever tell me such a thing? Well, the Torah teaches us you can't work it that way. God doesn't work it that way. God says, you know, sometimes people are in very tough situations, and then they think things or say things that they never meant to say. The Ramban says that this sacrifice, when it says it's a kapara, it doesn't mean an atonement. It means more like kofar. We say that kofar means redemption money. And the Torah, again, is treating childbirth as a near-death experience. And she has to bring a sacrifice of appreciation to God and say, hey God, you helped me. I made it. I'm alive. And that's what the sacrifice is. It's, so to speak, in redemption of the fact that she was allowed to live. She remained alive. The Rambam explains to us that before the Torah was given, the world used to view women, when they have their period, as a source of spiritual danger. And if a woman was having her period, so not only would people stay away from her, but anything she'd step on or sit on, they'd think, ooh, that has demons on it. They'd burn it. All her hair, that any haircut she got during that time, they'd burn. Any nails that she cut, they'd say, that has demons on it. They'd burn it. Came the Torah and said, no, I don't want you to send your wife, when she has her period, to an outhouse to live in a hut. That's not what the Torah wants. I don't want you to send it to another room. All I'm saying, the Torah says, there is a damaging effect if you're close to her. Don't touch her. A husband and his wife, the Torah came during a period, says the Rambam, where the world viewed women during their period as a source of demons. And the world was saying, even though the ground she steps on is damaging, the air she breathes is damaging. Came the Torah and said, no, she may not enter the temple, she does have some level of spiritual impurity, and her husband may not be as close as he is all the time, but he still owes her, says the Gemara, to have conversations of closeness when they're lying each one in his own bed at night. They're still supposed to have a certain level of intimate conversation, the level that's permitted. Yari.
Somewhere that in some Ethiopian communities, the Ethiopian Jewish communities, they would join the separate.
That's true. The Ethiopian communities did have a custom that she'd have a separate room, or she'd sleep with the kids, or she'd have a separate outhouse where she'd go to sleep. Depends on the community. That's not the halacha. The Rambam says not only is that not the halacha, but that the Torah came to preclude from those philosophies. What can you do?
When they came to Israel and they found that wasn't the case, they weren't supposed to do that, a lot of them had a problem with not going into
that. They had a problem. I'll tell you more than that. Ethiopian women, when they have their period, will not pass anything to another man. As a moel, I know this. Like, I come into an Ethiopian home, and the mother won't hand me the baby, because they're still going with these old philosophies, not the Torah way, that a woman during her period is very damaging. So they won't hand me the baby. They'll put the baby down and say, here, take it. They won't dare, like, they keep a distance, and they've been taught that all these improper thoughts, that are not Torah thoughts, it's not the way the Torah taught us. I don't think so. You don't see that the rabbi said that. The rabbi said that they have to...
They were in a different culture.
They were in a different culture, fine, but that doesn't make it Jewish.
They were... This is really unbelievable. I don't know how much you can enforce such...
This goes into the whole discussion of Ethiopians and their minhagim. that's a separate discussion. Let's leave it. You're assuming a lot of things with your question. I don't want to go into that discussion. Yeah. No, I don't want to go into it tomorrow night either, because our listeners might be very offended. I don't think it's important for our knowledge base, and I don't want to offend people.
It sounds like when you're saying it's very difficult. It's very difficult in that situation when the woman is impure, they're together in bed, conversating for 2 weeks. It would almost seem easier if there was some kind of separation. You know, that they shouldn't make any mistakes. You know?
Right, for sure.
They just have to.
Well, no, they separate the beds. They're each in their own bed. The beds have to be far enough apart that they won't come to touching one another. So that's what each person has to be care. Take care. Yeah, that's what the Torah entrusted into each Jewish home. Obviously, it's more difficult emotionally than keeping kosher. But by the same token, the Torah said that every Jew is trustworthy, that this is what he's doing in his home.
Critical reasons why being shown to give before you get married is so important. If you're together with someone for a year and 6 months, you spent the year and 6 months not touching the person.
Right.
2 weeks.
To an extent, a person also has to remember that touching a girl when he's dating her.
Touching a wife, I know it's different.
No, I'm saying also, she's a nida. Every girl is a nida. It's not just. That's a nice thing as an extension of this. It is this. Right, girls don't go to mikveh until they're married.
State of impurity.
Correct. It has no applications other than the fact that a man, a father, when we say he's touching his daughter, he's not touching her like a husband touches his wife. So that touch, he's allowed to touch her. A father is allowed to touch his daughter, a brother is allowed to touch a sister, a son's allowed to touch a mother. A husband is not allowed to touch a wife when she's in need.
So
it's not relevant for a girl. That's why girls.
A girl that theoretically, let's say, like, she's not showing me, but she still wants to be like. Would it be theoretically worse to go to the mikvah? Because, I mean, the same happens, let's face it.
She should ask her rabbi. Better ask her local rabbi. Part of the reason that our sages abolished girls going to mikveh before they're married is because if a girl goes to mikveh before she's married, then she feels, and the guy feels, oh, it's not so bad, she's not a nida. If she's a nida, so the Gemara says, look, if she's 1 day after menstruation, then his offsprings will die when they're 10 years old. If she's 2 days after the beginning of menstruation, then his offsprings will die by the time they're 20. If she's 3 days after menstruation, they'll die by the time they're 30. Etc. Our sages said that the Torah promises that if a person does not keep these laws, he will get kares. He will get cut off, which our sages understood to mean that his life will be shortened. On certain mitzvahs, the Torah says this, and one of them is the law of nida. So if girls go to mikveh, they say, that still applies today, yeah.
That's even when you're married?
Yeah, it's irrelevant. When a woman is a nida, the Torah prohibits it, and the Torah says that if one transgresses purposely, then he gets the... Purposely. We're not talking about a person that didn't know that his wife was such and such and she didn't know or whatever.
Well, it's like this generation, like...
They didn't know better?
We're not at such a high level.
Well, it doesn't work that way. Then we could take away the whole Torah.
In fact, matters, people even come to Pesach.
Right.
Children, I'm sure I can find someone that lives and their kid also...
So that's a separate discussion. No, that's a fair discussion. But I think for now, let's try to cover more of the parasha, because I don't want to leave everything for tomorrow night. Tomorrow we'll continue, if you guys want, on the parasha. Yeah?
Just one question. How much of this is dependent, like what you said about someone's life, Chametz or Pesach, is dependent on having Beit HaMikdash?
No, nothing we're discussing is connected to Beit HaMikdash. The law, these laws of Nida are today. Okay. Yeah, you want something? Let's try to cover a little bit more in the few minutes we have left. The Torah teaches us that a person could have a white blemish that will make him tamei. This white blemish is called tzaras. This is a miraculous effect. These white blemishes have to be of a certain color. And our sages had a tradition going back to Moshe, how this color works, what this color is. And the Gemara describes it. The Gemara says there are four different types of white blemishes. There's Baheres, which is a bold white. That's the most white that it gets. And that's like snow. And then you have Se'es, which is a drop less. And that's like clean wool. The day that a sheep is born, the wool is at its cleanest. That's that level of white. And then you have one step down is like the white... that they whiten the walls of the Heichal in the Beis HaMikdash. I don't know if it's like this plaster, some type of white that they seed that they put on the walls. And the last level, the bottom level, is like the little shell, you know, of an egg. An egg has a little encasing, right, that thin skin. So that whiteness, the whiteness that you see by an egg, that's the minimum white from there up. Anything that's whiter than that is going to probably be tzaras. Now, you have to have a tradition on what it is. And a kohen, when he sees it, will say, tameh or tahor. Until a kohen says so, it's not tameh. The kohen has to say it. Sometimes the kohen doesn't know. So he calls the rabbi, and the rabbi looks at it, and he says, I have a tradition, this is tameh. The guy is still pure. The kohen says, tameh, now the guy is tameh. Now everyone's standing under the same canopy as him, or things like that, they're going to be tameh. It's a problem. When a person has tzaras, the Torah says he has to exit the camp. He has to tear his clothing as though he were in mourning. He has to grow his hair. He has to separate from his wife. He's living all alone in some kind of outhouse, out of town. No one's coming near him. The idea is, tzaras, mitzora, comes from the words, motzi shem ra. This person said bad things about people. He was haughty. So the Torah says, he caused separation between people, he said bad things about people, he said Lashon Hara. God says, I'll cause separation between him and mankind. Let's say a person was unkind. A neighbor would knock on his door, could I borrow your hammer? No, I don't have a hammer. Could I borrow your sieve? The wife's going to say, no, I don't have a sieve. So then God says, oh, you guys don't want to lend things, I'll give you one in turn. And God makes a white blemish appear by a person's home. Now when a white blemish appears at a person's home, so then, if the kohen says that's tameh, so the stuff in the home are going to be tameh. So the kohen, the Torah says, is supposed to send word to the man, hey, take everything out of the house before I come. So that if I say it's tameh, all your objects won't get tameh. So the guy has a few minutes till the kohen comes, let's say he has an hour, 2 hours, he's going to start taking everything out of the house. All his neighbors see his yard filled, hey, there's that hammer. Didn't you just tell me yesterday you didn't have a hammer? There's that sieve. Didn't your wife just tell me you can't lend me a sieve? You don't have one? Oh... So the Torah says, hey, you don't want to be nice to your neighbors. So God sends a blemish to the house, and then the guy has to take everything out of the house, and everyone sees what kind of person he really is. A person doesn't learn his lesson when God sends a blemish to his garment or to his home, so then finally God sends a blemish to a person's skin. And these laws are miraculous laws. It's something like the waters of the Sota. We don't understand it. We have no natural explanation for it. We know that the Torah does tell us that it can harm other people. Once a person has tzaras, we, so to speak, send them out of the camp. We don't want him to contaminate other people. But in general, this is a spiritual illness, which we don't exactly understand. We do know that here we have an insight as to one of the Torah's philosophies, at least. When it comes to punishment, we know that there are different attitudes as to why we should punish. Sometimes we say it's a deterrent. Sometimes we say it's society's revenge. Well, the Torah's purpose in this punishment, at least, is to teach a person. Meaning, the Torah wants a person to do better. The Torah's goal isn't to deter him in the future from doing it. Who's going to say, I won't speak badly about someone, maybe I'll get a white sign. Maybe after it happens, we'll believe it could happen. But most people don't live in the fear of tzaras. But the Torah's doing this, that a person suddenly gets a white spot on his house. He's got to take everything out of the house. You guys ever move?
Yeah.
It's a real pain in the neck. Pack everything, take everything out, and especially on 1 minute's notice, suddenly there's a white spot. The coin comes in, they take apart part of the wall, they wait, and they see if it comes back, doesn't come back, makes a wreck of a person's life. Slowly but surely, gets closer, suddenly sees a spot on his bed, on his covers. God's sending him the message. And if he doesn't get the message and do tshuva, then finally the spot appears on himself and he has to exit the camp and he's got to think about his actions and do tshuva and hope that God will take away the tzaras. So the Torah over here in giving these punishments, the purpose of these punishments are educational. The Torah is trying to get the person to do tshuva before it reaches a point where he has to be kicked out of the camp and, so to speak, excommunicated. One of the aspects of Jewish philosophy that we learn from this mitzvah is the concept of hashgacha. We know that God watches over the world. And we know that there are different levels of hashgacha. There's a medrash that says that there isn't a blade of grass growing on this earth that doesn't have an angel corresponding to it, an angel that says, grow, grow. But our sages, one of the things that some are of the opinion that when it comes to hashgacha, so God watches over a species. We say, Poseach es yadecha, God opens his hands, umasbia lechol chai rason, and gives satiation to all live creatures that will it. So I always had a question. What about all those people in the Holocaust? They wanted food. Some died of hunger. What's pshat in the pasuk? Whoever wants food, God gives it to them. Well, sometimes there are people who want food and they die of hunger. So our sages taught us that the verse doesn't mean that. The verse means God opens his hands and he gives to all. It doesn't mean to every single one. It means to the species. All is a generalization, which means that in general, God gives to species. God watches over the species that every species won't die out. God gives them sustenance that they don't die of hunger. And this applies in general also to the nations. We say that the nations don't have the level of hashgacha like us. The verse says in Tehillim, Asaf, Korach's son. He saw the ground open up from under them and whoop, his father fell down. And he was on his way down to perdition and his brothers and they said, God, we give in. Moshe is telling the truth. And whoop, they were taken out. Korach was going down and till he hit rock bottom, he didn't give in. So his children compiled different verses of Tehillim. And one of the verses, verse 73, Ayin Gimel, Asaf, one of Korach's son, says, Ach tov liYisrael Elokim, God is but good to the Jewish people, levarei levav, to those that are pure of heart. And our sages teach us that the word ach is a very special word. We know in Hebrew every word has a numeric value. Where's David? Ach is 21. You take the first letter of each of the books in the Torah, they all add up to 21. You take the name of God, Ehiyeh, God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, Ehiyeh Asher Ehiyeh, that's 21. The word ach refers to God himself. Ach tov li Yisrael Elokim. God is but good to the Jewish people. God is good to the world. But God has a special good, a special hashgacha for the Jewish people. And the more pious a person is, the higher his level of hashgacha is. That depends each person according to his level. There is a special hashgacha to the land of Israel. And so, our parasha teaches us the mitzvah of tzaras in a home, only in the land of Israel. There's no concept of tzaras in a home outside Israel. And only a Jew can get tzaras. This is a spiritual illness. And this is coming to strengthen our knowledge of the fact that God is watching over us. Bezrat Hashem, we will meet tomorrow night. I hope we will...